Access number 11732, reel 3.
Mr. Barlow, reel 3.
It would take three months. And I was told in no uncertain terms, you will never get a more important job to do ever than this. And without really having a clue on how I was going to do it, I said, I'll get them running for you in three weeks. And I went back to the office the next morning, told my managing director, who was also an engineer, and I didn't repeat what he said to me because he couldn't believe it. And he then went on to say, but having said that, I know you'll do it, Jack. The company's yours. Everybody in the company will be told that you're on a special job and they must do exactly what you ask them to do. And that goes for me as well. If I can help you, I will. I only had one lad, because it was a special type of conveyor, I only had one junior draftsman that could help me. We'd done 40 drawings in a week, with me doing the main drawings and him doing some of the subsidiary ones. And I left him doing some of the subsidiary ones. The first conveyor ran exactly 2 weeks to the day after I made the promise. I'd measured up the site while I was there to save going back again. And the second conveyor ran exactly 3 weeks to the day from when I made the promise. And I should never know quite how I achieved it. But never have I been involved in anything like this in the whole of my life. And every day after that, you see, I was told the conveyors must run non-stop, night and day, for 3 months, by which time they wouldn't be required anymore because the invasion would have moved. We should have moved more or less overseas and got our headquarters overseas. But every day after the conveyors were running, I had to ring Commander Courage, who I was dealing with, and he would tell me how things were. And there was a sort of side issue to this. You see, the mansion, which laid in huge grounds of its own, had its own direct current. So I supplied DC motors for direct current, but I did tell Commander Courage that DC motors were inclined to be a bit noisy. And after they'd been running for 2 or 3 days, he rang me up one day and he said, look, Mr. Barlow, he said, these conveyors are too noisy. He said, we shall have to do something about them. I said, well, I told you originally they'd be too noisy, but I said, what are you going to do about your AC supply? He said, that's my problem. How soon can you get me DC motors here? Well, I realised that by the time we got a lorry, got it organised, and I had AC motors for a post office job which I could divert, and I said 6 hours, and he said, well, right, get them there in 6 hours for me. Well, next morning I couldn't get down to Southwick Park fast enough. When I got down there, I was met by one of our two smiling erectors, and I said, have you got those motors yet? He said, got the motors? He said, yes. He said, got the motors and they're running. I said, what the devil did you do? Oh, he said, Commander Courage just got hold of sappers from Portsmouth. He said they came over. He said they put poles up right across the park, diverted the supply in the village a mile away, ran wires right across the park. He said, we were waiting for your motors to arrive. And this brings me to the point that during the war, I dealt with, I'm probably going to upset someone here, but that's just too bad. I dealt with all the services during the war, and none came up to the Admiralty. With the other services, what would happen was I'd meet someone, and as soon as there was a problem, they would say, well, I must call in so-and-so. And they'd call this chap in, and he'd be a very nice fellow until I asked him the same question. And he'd say, well, I think we ought to get hold of so-and-so. We would end up with 10, sometimes 12 people, even during the war, and none of them would make a decision, particularly if cost was involved. And I've ended up saying, well, look, we'll do this and we'll do it that way and we won't charge you for it. But with the Admiralty, and particularly with Commander Courage, he consulted the other people and then took his own decision. And I've always come to the conclusion it is because the naval men are used to, in the end, having to take their own decisions because they're moths for anywhere and they take their own decisions. And I have the highest regard for Commander Courage, and there's a sideline, the funniest thing that could possibly have happened over this. Some months later, after I'd been phoning up every day for about a week or 10 days, sometimes they'd say he was out and I'd say, well, perhaps he'll ring me back, and he'd agree that the car's working all right. But on this particular occasion, he wasn't there, and I said, well, perhaps he can ring me back. They said, oh, he's not coming back, he's left. And, of course, I felt certain, well, the invasion isn't very far away, because all the time we were working together, every time I saw him on this job, he would say, oh, they don't forget me, Mr. Barlow. I'm a seaman, not a shore man. Just because I'm getting this place operational, I don't want to be lost for the invasion. He said, I want a boat. This is all he used to say to me, because if I went down there, on this job, I saw more top brass than ever I saw in my life, because I would go down there as a civilian and I'd go in the wardroom at lunch and I'd sit with a general on one side of me, an admiral on the other side, and an air marshal on the opposite side, because everybody was an officer, and even the wrens operating the teleprinter machines were officers as well. And the movement was absolutely fantastic, because the first time I went down, there were croaky hooks on the lawn, and when I went down the next time, only about 4 or 5 days afterwards, the croaky hooks had gone. There were Nissen huts erected. There were teleprinters on benches all along each side, and they were wired up. And the wiring on teleprinters is fantastic. There's an awful amount of of electrical wiring on teleprinters. And they were wired up, and they were training these officers in the use of them at the headquarters. But anyway, 2 or 3 months after the invasion had actually started, I had to go up to London to a newspaper office about some conveyors. I bought a paper to read on the train back to Dartford, and spotted a photograph which the caption underneath was high ranking German officers being escorted ashore at Dover. And in this photograph, I was certain I could see Commander Courage following these particular German officers. I rushed straight back into the newspaper offices, told them the story, and I mean, you know that newspaper photographs aren't particularly bright, and they printed me a proper 12 by 10, and it was very definitely my Commander Courage. And I kept that photograph for many years. It wasn't until I moved here 10 years ago that, in turning stuff out, I let it go. I'd kept it because of all the people I met, and I met an awful lot of people during my full working life. Commander Courage, I always considered, was the greatest gentleman that I ever met.
Was this Commander Richard Courage?
Richard
Courage, was it?
I don't know what his first name was. I only know he was a Commander Courage.
Sounds as though you made friends with him.
I did. He was a great, great man.
What was the name of the firm for which you were working?
Sovex Limited, S-O-V-E-X.
What were industrial relations like in your firm, in your factory, during the war? Did you get the strikes and industrial action that you sometimes do nowadays?
No. The word strike didn't occur during the war. Another example of what I was saying much earlier on, the cooperation you got, that has never happened since.
Did you have trade unions in your factory?
We didn't then. Later on, after the war, we got it. But I left soon afterwards and came up to the Midlands.